This weakening of character, with a corresponding loss of health, may have led to a diminution of his psychic powers, and increased the temptation to resort to trickery. Making every allowance for the difficulty of distinguishing what is fraud and what is of crude psychic origin, an unpleasant impression is left upon the mind by the evidence given in the Siebert Commission and by the fact that spiritualists upon the spot should have condemned his action. Human frailty, however, is one thing and psychic power is another. Those who seek evidence for the latter will find ample in those years when the man and his powers were both at their zenith. Slade died in 1905 at a Michigan sanatorium to which he had been sent by the American spiritualists, and the announcement was followed by the customary sort of comment in the London press. The Star, which has an evil tradition in psychic matters, printed a sensational article headed, "Spook Swindles," giving a garbled account of the Lancaster prosecution at Bow Street. Referring to this, Light says, "Of course, this whole thing is a hash of ignorance, unfairness and prejudice. We do not care to discuss it or to controvert it. It would be useless to do so for the sake of the unfair, the ignorant, and the prejudiced, and it is not necessary for those who know." Suffice it to say that the Star only supplies one more instance of the difficulty of getting all the facts before the public, but the prejudiced newspapers have themselves to blame for their ignorance or inaccuracy. Dr. Monk. It is the story of and mask line over again. If Slade's career is difficult to appraise, and if one is forced to admit that, while there was an overpowering preponderance of psychic results, there was also a residuum which left the unpleasant impression that the medium might supplement truth with fraud, the same admission must be made in the case of the medium Monk, who played a considerable part for some years in the 70s. Of all mediums, none is more difficult to appraise, for on the one hand many of his results are beyond all dispute, while in a few there seems to be an absolute certainty of dishonesty. In his case, as in Slade's, there were physical causes which would account for a degeneration of the moral and psychic powers. Monk was a nonconformist clergyman, a favorite pupil of the famous Spurgeon. According to his own account, he had been subject from childhood to psychic influences, which increased with his growth. In 1873 he announced his adhesion to spiritualism and gave an address in the Cavendish Rooms. Shortly afterwards he began to give demonstrations, which appear to have been unpaid and were given in Light. In 1875 he made a tour through England and Scotland, his performances exciting much attention and debate, and in 1876 he visited Ireland, where his powers were directed towards healing. Hence he was usually known as Dr. Alfred Russel Wallace. A most competent and honest observer, has given an account of a materialization seance with Monk which appears to be as critic, proof as such a thing could be. No subsequent suspicion or conviction can ever eliminate such an incontrovertible instance of psychic power. It is to be noted how far the effects were in agreement with the subsequent demonstrations of ectoplasmic outflow in the case of Eva and other modern mediums. Dr. Wallace's companions upon this occasion were Mr. Stainton Moses and Mr. Hensley Wedgwood. Dr. Wallace writes, "It was a bright summer afternoon, and everything happened in the full light of day. After a little conversation, Monk, who was dressed in the usual clerical black, appeared to go into a trance, then stood up a few feet in front of us, and after a little while pointed to his side, saying, 'Look! We saw there a faint white patch on his coat on the left side. This grew brighter, then seemed to flicker and extend both upwards and downwards, till very gradually it formed a cloudy pillar extending from his shoulder to his feet and close to his body.'" Dr. Wallace goes on to describe how the cloudy figure finally assumed the form of a thickly draped woman, who, after a brief space, appeared to be absorbed into the body of the medium. He adds, "The whole process of the formation of a shrouded figure was seen in full daylight." Mr. Wedgwood assured him that he had had even more remarkable manifestations of this kind with Monk, when the medium was in a deep trance, and in full view. It is quite impossible after such evidence to doubt the powers of the medium at that time. Archdeacon Kelly, who had seen similar exhibitions, offered a prize of £1,000 to Mr. J. N. Maskline, the famous conjurer, if he could duplicate the performance. This challenge was accepted by Mr. Maskline, but the evidence showed that the imitation bore no relation to the original. He attempted to gain a decision in the courts, but the verdict was against him. It is interesting to compare the account given by Russell Wallace and the experience later of a well-known American, Judge Daly. This gentleman wrote, "Glancing at Dr. Monk's side, we observed what looked like an opalescent mass of compact steam emerging from just below his heart on the left side. It increased in volume, rising up and extending downward. The upper portions taking the form of a child's head, the face being distinguished as that of a little child I had lost some 20 years previously. It only remained in this form for a moment, and then suddenly disappeared, seeming to be instantly absorbed into the doctor's side. This remarkable phenomenon was repeated 4 or 5 times, in each instance the materialization being more distinct than the preceding one. This was witnessed by all in the room, with gas burning sufficiently bright for every object in the room to be plainly visible. It was a phenomenon seldom to be seen, and has enabled all who saw it to vouch for, not only the remarkable power possessed by Dr. Monk as a materializing medium, but, as to the wonderful manner in which a spirit draws out this position our hands were never moved till I untied the slates to ascertain the result. Surely it is vain after such testimony to deny that Monk had, indeed, great psychic powers. Apart from materializations, Dr. Monk was a remarkable slate, writing medium. Dr. Russell Wallace, in a letter to the Spectator, says that with Monk at a private house in Richmond he cleaned 2 slates, and after placing a fragment of pencil between them, tied them together tightly with a strong cord, lengthways and crosswise, in a manner that prevented any movement. I then laid them flat on the table without losing sight of them for an instant. Dr. Monk placed the fingers of both hands on them, while I and a lady sitting opposite placed our hands on the corners of the slates. From this position our hands were never moved till I untied the dot slates to ascertain the result. Monk asked Wallace to name a word to be written on the slate. He chose the word God and in answer to a request decided that it should be lengthways on the slate. The sound of writing was heard, and when the medium's hands were withdrawn, Drive Wallace opened the slates and found on the lower one the word he had asked for and written in the manner requested. Dr. Wallace says, "The essential features of this experiment are that I myself cleaned and tied up the slates, that I kept my hands on them all the time, but they never went out of my sight for a moment, and that I named the word to be written, and the manner of writing it after they were thus secured and held by me." Mr. Edward T. Bennett, Assistant Secretary to the Society for Psychical Research, adds to this account, "I was present on this occasion, and certify that Mr. Wallace's account of what happened is correct." Another good test is described by Mr. W. P. Atshed, of Helper, a well known investigator, who says of a stance held in Derby on September 18, 1876, there were 8 persons present, 3 ladies and 5 gentlemen. A lady whom Dr. Monk had never before seen had a slate passed to her by a sitter, which she examined and found clean. The slate pencil which was on the table a few minutes before we sat down could not be found. An investigator suggested that it would be a good test if a lead pencil were used. Accordingly, a lead pencil was put on the slate, and the lady held both under the table. The sound of writing was instantly heard, and in a few seconds a communication had been written filling one side of the slate. The writing was done in lead, and was very small and neat, and alluded to a strictly private matter. Here were 3 tests at once. I. Writing was obtained without the medium, or any other person but the lady, touching the slate from first to last. 2. It was written with lead pencil at the spontaneous suggestion of another stranger. 3. It gave an important test communication regarding a matter that was strictly private. Dr. Monk did not so much as touch the slate from first to last. Mr. Adshed also speaks of physical phenomena occurring freely with this medium when his hands were closely confined in an apparatus called their stocks, which did not permit movement of even an inch in any direction. In the year 1876, the Slade trial was going on in London, as already described, and exposures were in the air. In considering the following rather puzzling and certainly suspicious case, one has to remember that when a man who is a public performer, a conjurer or a mesmerist, can pose as having exposed a medium, he wins a valuable public advertisement and attracts to himself all that very numerous section of the community who desire to see such an exposure. It is only fair to bear this in mind in endeavoring to hold the scales fair where there is a conflict of evidence. In this case, the conjurer and mesmerist was one lodge, and the occasion was a stance held at Huddersfield on November 3, 1876. Mr. Lodge suddenly demanded that the medium be searched. Monk, whether dreading assault or to save himself exposure, ran upstairs and locked himself in his room. He then let himself down from his window and made for the police office, where he lodged a complaint as to his treatment. The door of his bedroom had been forced and his effects searched, with the result that a pair of stuffed gloves was found. Monk asserted that these gloves had been made for a lecture in which he had exposed the difference between conjuring and mediumship. Still, as a spiritualist paper remarked at the time, the phenomena of his mediumship do not rest on his probity at all. If he were the greatest rogue and the most accomplished conjurer rolled into one, it would not account for the manifestations which have been reported of him. Monk was sentenced to 3 months' imprisonment, and is alleged to have made a confession to Mr. Lodge. After his release from prison, Monk held a number of test sittings with Stainton Moses, at which remarkable phenomena occurred. Like comments, those whose names we have mentioned as testifying to the genuineness of Dr. Monk's mediumship are well known to the older spiritualists as keen and scrupulously cautious experimenters, and Mr. Hensley Wedgwood's name carried much weight, as he was known as a man of science and was brother, in Law of Charles Darwin. There is an element of doubt about the Huddersfield case, as the accuser was by no means an impartial person, but Sir William Barrett's testimony makes it clear that Monk did sometimes descend to deliberate and cold-blooded trickery. Sir William writes, "I caught the doctor in a gross bit of fraud, a piece of white muslin on a wire frame with a black thread attached, being used by the medium to simulate a partially materialized spirit. Such an exposure, coming from so sure a source, arouses a feeling of disgust which urges one to throw the whole evidence concerning the man into the waste paper basket. One must, however, be patient and reasonable in such matters." Monk's earlier stances, as has been clearly shown, were in good light, and any such clumsy mechanism was out of the question. We must not argue that because a man once forges, therefore he has never signed an honest check in his life. But we must clearly admit that Monk was capable of fraud, that he would take the easier way when things were difficult, and that each of his manifestations should be carefully checked. Chapter 14, Collective Investigations of Spiritualism. Several committees have at different times sat upon the subject of spiritualism. Of these, the two most important are that of the Dialectical Society in 1869-70, and the Seabutt Commission in 1884. The first British and the second American. To these may be added that of the French Society, Institut General Psychologique in 1905-8. In spite of the intervals between these various investigations, it will be convenient to treat them in a single chapter as certain remarks in common apply to each of them. There are obvious difficulties in the way of collective investigations, difficulties which are so grave that they are almost insurmountable. When a Crookes or a Lombroso explores the subject, he either sits alone with the medium, or he has with him others whose knowledge of psychic conditions and laws may be helpful in the matter. This is not usually so with these committees. They fail to understand that they are themselves part of the experiment, and that it is possible for them to create such intolerable vibrations, and to surround themselves with so negative an atmosphere, that these outside forces, which are governed by very definite laws, are unable to penetrate it. It is not in vain that the three words, with one accord, are interpolated into the account of the apostolic sitting in the upper room. If a small piece of metal may upset a whole magnetic installation, so a strong adverse psychic current may ruin a psychic circle. It is for this reason, and not on account of any superior credulity, that practicing spiritualists continually get such results as are never attained by mere researchers. This also may be the reason why the one committee upon which spiritualists were fairly well represented was the one which gained the most positive results. This was the committee which was chosen by the Dialectical Society of London, a committee which began its explorations early in 1869 and presented its report in 1871. If common sense and the ordinary laws of evidence had been followed in the reception of this report, the progress of psychic truth would have been accelerated by 50 years. 30. Four gentlemen of standing were appointed upon this committee, the terms of reference being, to investigate the phenomena alleged to be spiritual manifestations. The majority of the members were certainly in the mood to unmask an imposture, but they encountered a body of evidence which could not be disregarded, and they ended by asserting that the subject is worthy of more serious attention and careful investigation than it has hitherto received. This conclusion so amazed the society which they represented that they could not get it to publish the findings, so the committee in a spirited way published them at their own cost, thus giving permanent record to a most interesting investigation. The members of the committee were drawn from many varied professions and included a doctor of divinity, two physicians, two surgeons, two civil engineers, two fellows of scientific societies, two barristers, and others of repute. Charles Bradlaugh the rationalist was a member. Professor Huxley and G. H. Lewis, the consort of George Eliot, were invited to co-operate, but both refused, Huxley stating in his reply that, supposing the phenomena to be genuine, they do not interest me, a dictum which showed that this great and clear headed man had his limitations. The six sub-committees sat 40 times under test conditions, often without the aid of a professional medium, and with a full sense of responsibility they agreed that the following points appeared to have been established: I. That sounds of a very varied character, apparently proceeding from articles of furniture, the floor and walls of the room, the vibrations accompanying which sounds are often distinctly perceptible to the touch, occurred, without being produced by muscular action or mechanical contrivance. 2. That movements of heavy bodies take place without mechanical contrivance of any kind or adequate exertion of muscular force by the persons present, and frequently without contact or connection with any person. 3. That these sounds and movements often occur at the times and in the manner asked for by persons present, and, by means of a simple code of signals, answer questions and spell out coherent communications. 4. That the answers and communications thus obtained are, for the most part, of a commonplace character, but facts are sometimes correctly given which are only known to one of the persons present. 5. That the circumstances under which the phenomena occur are variable, the most prominent fact being that the presence of certain persons seems necessary to their occurrence, and that of others generally adverse, but this difference does not appear to depend upon any belief or disbelief concerning the phenomena. 6. That, nevertheless, the occurrence of the phenomena is not ensured by the presence or absence of such persons respectively. The report briefly summarizes as follows the oral and written evidence received, which not only testifies to phenomena of the same nature as those witnessed by the sub-committees, but to others of a more varied and extraordinary character. I. 13 witnesses state that they have seen heavy bodies, in some instances men, rise slowly in the air and remain there for some time without visible or tangible support. 322. 14 witnesses testify to having seen hands or figures, not appertaining to any human being, but lifelike in appearance and mobility, which they have sometimes touched or even grasped, and which they are therefore convinced were not the result of imposture or illusion. 3. 5 witnesses state that they have been touched by some invisible agency on various parts of the body, and often were requested, when the hands of all present were visible. 4. 13 witnesses declare that they have heard musical pieces well played upon instruments, not manipulated by any ascertainable agency. 5. 5 witnesses state that they have seen red, Hot coals applied to the hands or heads of several persons without producing pain or scorching, and three witnesses state that they have had the same experiment made upon themselves with the like immunity. 6. 8 witnesses state that they have received precise information through wrappings, writings, and in other ways, the accuracy of which was unknown at the time to themselves or to any persons present, and which on subsequent inquiry was found to be correct. 7. One witness declares that he has received a precise and detailed statement which, nevertheless, proved to be entirely erroneous. 8. Three witnesses state that they have been present when drawings, both in pencil and colors, were produced in so short a time, and under such conditions as to render human agency impossible. 9. Six witnesses declare that they have received information of future events, and that in some cases the hour and minute of their occurrence have been accurately foretold, days and even weeks before. In addition to the above, evidence was given of trance, speaking, of healing, of automatic writing, of the introduction of flowers and fruits into closed rooms, of voices in the air, of visions in crystals and glasses, and of the elongation of the human body. The report closes with the following observations. In presenting their report, your committee, taking into consideration the high character and great intelligence of many of the witnesses to the more extraordinary facts, the extent to which their testimony is supported by the reports of the sub-committees, and the absence of any proof of imposture or delusion as regards a large portion of the phenomena, and further, having regard to the exceptional character of the phenomena, the large number of persons in every grade of society and over the whole civilized world who are more or less influenced by a belief in their supernatural origin, and to the fact that no philosophical explanation of them has yet been arrived at, deem it incumbent upon them to state their conviction that the subject is worthy of more serious attention and careful investigation than it has hitherto received. 322. Among those who gave evidence, or read papers before the committee were, Dr. Alfred Russell Wallace, Mrs. Emma Harding, Mr. H. D. Jenkin, Mr. Benjamin Coleman, Mr. Cromwell F. Varley, Mr. D. D. Holm, and the Master of Lindsay. Correspondence was received from Lord Lytton, Mr. Robert Chambers, Dr. Garth Wilkinson, Mr. William Howitt, M. Camille Flammarion, and others. The committee was successful in procuring the evidence of believers in the phenomena, but almost wholly failed, as stated in its report, to obtain evidence from those who attributed them to fraud or delusion. In the records of the evidence of over 50 witnesses, there is voluminous testimony to the existence of the facts from men and women of good standing. One witness considered that the most remarkable phenomenon brought to light by the labors of the committee was the extraordinary number of eminent men who were shown to be firm believers in the spiritual hypothesis. And another F. declared that whatever agencies might be employed in these manifestations, they were not to be explained by referring them to imposture on the one side or hallucination on the other. An interesting sidelight on the growth of the movement is obtained from Mrs. Emma Harding's statement that at that time, 1869, she knew only two professional mediums in London, though she was acquainted with several non-professional ones. As she Grat Tangieri. T. E. L. Blanchard. 383, herself was a medium. She was probably correct in what she said. Mr. Cromwell Varley averred that there were probably not more than 100 known mediums in the whole kingdom, and he added that very few of those were well developed. We have here conclusive testimony to the great work accomplished in England by D. D. Holm, for the bulk of the converts were due to his mediumship. Another medium who played an important part was Mrs. Marshall. Many witnesses spoke of evidential sittings they had attended at her house. Mr. William Howitt, the well-known author, was of opinion that spiritualism had then received the assent of about 20 millions of people in all countries after personal examination. What may be called the evidence for the opposition was not at all formidable. Lord Lytton said that in his experience the phenomena were traceable to material influences of whose nature we were ignorant. Dr. Carpenter brought out his pet hobby of unconscious cerebration. Dr. Kidd thought that the majority were evidently subjective phenomena, and three witnesses, while convinced of the genuineness of the occurrences, ascribed them to satanic agency. These objections were well answered by Mr. Thomas Shorter, author of Confessions of a Truth Seeker, and secretary of the Working Men's College, in an admirable review of the report in the Spiritual magazine. It is worthy of note that on the publication of this important and well-considered report it was ridiculed by a large part of the London press. An honourable exception was the Spectator. The Times reviewer considered it nothing more than a farrago of impotent conclusions, garnished by a mass of the most monstrous rubbish it has ever been our misfortune to sit in judgment upon. The Morning Post said, "The report which has been published is entirely worthless." The Saturday Review hoped that report would involuntarily lead to discrediting a little further one of the most unequivocally degrading superstitions that have ever found currency among reasonable beings. The Standard made a sound criticism that deserves to be remembered. Objecting to the remark of those who do not believe in spiritualism, yet say that there may be something in it, the newspaper sagely observes, "If there is anything whatever in it, beyond imposture and imbecility, there is the whole of another world in it." The Daily News regarded the report as an important contribution to the literature of a subject which, someday or other, by the very number of its followers, will demand more extended investigation. The Spectator, after describing the book as an extremely curious one, added, "Few, however, could read the mass of evidence collected in this volume, showing the firm faith in the reality of the alleged spiritual phenomena possessed by a number of individuals of honorable and upright character, without also agreeing with Mr. Jeffrey's opinion that the remarkable phenomena witnessed, some of which had not been traced to imposture or delusion, and the gathered testimony of respectable witnesses, justify the recommendation of the subject to further cautious investigation." These are but brief extracts from long notices in a few of the London newspapers. There were many others, and, bad as they are, they nonetheless indicate a change of attitude on the part of the press, which had been in the habit of ignoring the subject altogether. It must be remembered that the report concerned itself only with the phenomenal aspect of spiritualism, and this, in the opinion of leading spiritualists, is decidedly the less important side. Only in the report of one sub-committee is it recorded that the general gist of the messages was that physical death was a trivial matter in retrospect, but that for the spirit it was a rebirth into new experiences of existence, that spirit life was in every respect human, that friendly intercourse was as common and pleasurable as in life, that although spirits took great interest in worldly affairs, they had no wish to return to their former state of existence, that communication with earth friends was pleasurable and desired by spirits, being intended as a proof to the former of the continuance of life in spite of bodily dissolution, and that spirits claimed no certain prophetic power. These were the main heads of the information received. It will be generally recognized in the future that, in their day and generation, the Dialectical Society's committee did excellent work. The great majority of the members were opposed to the psychic claims, but in the face of evidence, with a few exceptions, such as Dr. Edmonds, they yielded to the testimony of their own senses. There were a few examples of intolerance, such as Huxley's unhappy dictum, and Charles Bradlaugh's declaration that he would not even examine certain things because they were in the region of the impossible, but on the whole the teamwork of the sub-committees was excellent. There appears in the report of the Dialectical Society's committee a long article by Dr. Edmonds, an opponent to spiritualism, and to the findings of his colleagues. It is worth reading as typical of a certain class of mind. The worthy doctor, while imagining himself to be impartial, is really so absolutely prejudiced that the conceivable possibility of the phenomena being supernormal never is allowed to enter into his mind. When he sees one with his own eyes, his only question is, how was the trick done? If he cannot answer the question, he does not consider this to be in favor of some other explanation, but simply records that he cannot discover the trick. Thus his evidence, which is perfectly honest as to fact, records that a number of fresh flowers and fruits, still wet, fell upon the table, a phenomenon of apports which was shown many times by Mrs. Guppy. The doctor's only comment is that they must have been taken from the sideboard, although one would have imagined that a large basket of fruit upon the sideboard would have attracted attention, and he does not venture to say that he saw such an object.